You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good day, Colorado, and thank you for joining us for the March 26th reading of the environment. My name is John. I've prepared three articles for today. Each of the articles is from the magazine of the Sierra Club. First, new challenges put bald eagle recovery in peril. Next up, should I be worried about bird flu? And finally, time permitting, what's happening at the Bureau of Land Management? Back to Article 1. New challenges put bald eagle recovery in peril. Climate change and development could threaten this remarkable comeback. Written by Molly McCluskey. Each November, thousands of bald eagles descend on the Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve, a 48,000-acre state park in southeast Alaska's Chilkat Valley. The convocation is one of the largest gatherings of bald eagles anywhere in the world. It is made possible by an abundant supply of late salmon runs, ideal nesting and roosting sites in old-growth forests along coastlines and river corridors, and limited human disturbance during critical nesting and feeding periods. Alaska, and particularly the Chilkat Valley, is becoming increasingly known for biodiversity and for some resilience to climate change, Stacy Evans, the science director for the Tashinook Watershed Council, told Sierra. We definitely suspect that we'll become a refuge as habitat is degraded in other places. But as climate change-related drought, fire, and other natural disasters accelerate and human activity encroaches ever closer, this natural spectacle faces mounting threats. Eagles want to be where their food source is. They build nests overhanging the rivers or as close to them as they can, said wildlife expert and author Dave Hancock, who has spent more than 50 years monitoring bald eagle populations in Alaska, British Columbia, and elsewhere. They need to be able to catch their food and carry it to their nest. And they're very territorial, so eagles spread out along the whole coast during the nesting season, very much in relationship of a distance that they can control. Among the nests he actively monitors in the Fraser Valley are those on golf courses and in a small pocket park in Vancouver. I have one little park with three nests, and the nests are all 20, 30 meters, approximately 65 to 98 feet apart. And that's not good, Hancock told Sierra. I have to tell you, when they start to nest that close together, they spend more time arguing. They should be spread out in linear fashion closer to 500 meters or 1,600 feet apart. During the annual Congress in Haines, the town throws a bald eagle festival, which attracts visitors from throughout Alaska, parts of Canada, and some of the lower 48 for a series of workshops and exhibitions. Evans leads an annual bald eagle survey coinciding with the festival that focuses less on strict population numbers and more on where and how far apart the birds are gathering. The 2024 bald eagle survey found the eagle population was about half of that in the 2023 findings. The eagles seem to be congregating less here. We do still have a spectacular congregation, but it's not like it was in the 80s, where you go out to the preserve grounds and it was just eagles as far as the eye can see, Evans said. Eagles did not always find refuge in the last frontier. From 1917 until 1953, salmon fishermen and fox hunters in Alaska, then a territory, claimed that the birds of prey were competing with their livelihoods. Although there was no credence to their claim, officials bowed to political pressure and put a bounty on their heads. More than 120,000 eagles were killed during this period, with officials at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game estimating the unofficial tally to be much higher. The destruction was so widespread that as early as March 1930, an article in Popular Science warned, "In a few years, the American bald eagle will be seen only on coins and the coat of arms of the United States unless drastic action is taken to save these birds." When Alaska became a state in 1959, Alaska's bald eagles were protected by the Federal Bald Eagle Protection Act, which made it illegal to kill or own an eagle or possess any of their body parts. There are exceptions for members of federally recognized indigenous Americans. The publication of Silent Spring in 1962 by Rachel Carson drew national attention to the harmful effects of the pesticide DDT, including its role in thinning bald eagles' eggshells and causing reproductive failure. This led to the pesticide's U.S. ban in 1972. In 1978, the federal government went even further, listing bald eagles as endangered under the Endangered Species Act, which provided legal protection, habitat conservation measures, and recovery efforts. This included restricting human activities near nesting sites and rehabilitating damaged habitats, among other protections. By 2007, the population had recovered enough that officials removed bald eagles from the Endangered Species Act. However, they are still protected under the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Meanwhile, individual states began downgrading protections as local populations rebounded. California delisted bald eagles from the state's Endangered Species Act in 2011. Lawmakers in New Jersey removed the birds from its endangered species list in January 2025. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the federal agency that implements the Endangered Species Act, reported that the total population in the lower 48 had surpassed 316,000 eagles by 2021. Canada's Department of the Environment and Climate Change estimates there are 110,000 in the country. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says there are 30,000 bald eagles in the state, more than anywhere else in the United States. While experts say the overall population is stable in Alaska, Jones Hotz Jr., the tribal council president of the Chilkat Indian village of Klukwan in southeast Alaska, shares the concerns of Evans, Hancock, and others who have observed changing migration patterns. They say the pattern reflects a worrying trend. The health of the Chilkat River, which provides the eagles with a reliable source of salmon, is threatened by both human development and environmental changes. They used to call Alaska the last frontier. I think there's a lot of truth to that now, Hotz said. The reality of it is, we are eyeball to eyeball with losing our way of life forever. A proposed mine near the preserve and a highway project running through it are causing concern among local experts who worry about the impact on the salmon, the eagle population, and the health of the overall ecosystem. The trees in the preserve are protected, Evan says, but the ones just outside the boundary on the highway are not. And those are nesting trees as well. What's to keep them from being chopped down in the interests of a highway? The Chilkat Indian Reservation has vigorously opposed the mine, citing the lack of safeguards to protect the watershed. We must keep the watershed pristine. It's not just for our subsistence, our way of life, Hotz said. Salmon have been taking care of us for centuries, and now it's our turn to take care of them. Not only the eagles, but the entire ecosystem depends on it. Politics, too, could jeopardize the preserve. In early 2024, Alaska's Republican governor, Mike Dunleavy, proposed disbanding the Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve's Advisory Council. The plan was canceled after a community uproar, but critics feared the motivation to eliminate oversight at the preserve to pave the way for industrial mining still exists. Anything that happens in that preserve can impact the eagles returning, Kathy Brenner, the avian curator and executive director of the American Bald Eagle Foundation in Haines, told Sierra. Not necessarily their population, because these eagles are coming from all over southeast Alaska and Canada. They're not resident Haines eagles that are gathering out there. If the preserve is impacted, the eagles may just find somewhere else to go. That change in migration patterns was evident last spring when an eagle's nest was spotted in Toronto for the first time in recorded history. When the bald eagle first appeared on the United States national seal in 1782, it did so against the staunch wishes of founding father Benjamin Franklin, who considered the bird of prey a bird of bad moral character who does not get his living honestly. Despite this, the eagle has been so intertwined with the American legend since then that when President Biden signed a bill officially naming it the national bird of the United States in December 2024, many, if not all Americans, thought it had long been. Brenner is thrilled. I think this is amazing, and it's going to help the bald eagle because it's our national symbol, she says. It's going to remind people that we need to protect it. Our next article comes to us from Melody Schreiber and is titled, Should I Be Worried About Bird Flu? H5N1 is making headlines in 2025, even though it's been around for a surprisingly long time. Scientists often debate where the next pandemic will come from and what virus will cause it, but they tend to agree on one thing. At some point, the world will see another flu pandemic. If you go back in history, there are a lot of flu pandemics, said Jennifer Nuzzo, professor of epidemiology and director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University School of Public Health. Pandemics actually happen somewhat regularly. Of particular concern are the strains of flu that jump from animals to people and cause severe illness and death. That's why H5N1, a strain of avian influenza or bird flu, is raising alarms in the United States. It's rare for people to get H5N1, with only 954 deaths documented over the past two decades. But among those with known infections, the global mortality rate is 49%. Even if that rate were halved, Nuzzo said, it would be a major emergency. 25% mortality is like nothing we've seen. COVID is like 1%. H5N1 was first detected in 1959 on a Scottish chicken farm, but it only gained notoriety decades later, in 1996, when it began spreading from a goose farm to people in Guangdong, China. That outbreak proved deadly, claiming the lives of half of the people who tested positive, and it vaulted H5N1 into the international spotlight. Realizing how deadly H5N1 was and how easily it spread among birds is what made U.S. officials start preparing for a flu pandemic in the early 2000s. Since then, we've had sporadic outbreaks of H5N1 along with other avian influenzas. But what's happening now is a different story. Where do we stand on the current outbreak of avian flu? The strain of H5N1 currently making headlines first appeared in North America in late 2021, and it has been jumping species in novel, worrying ways. Birds migrating to this continent from Europe brought over an avian flu virus able to infect mammals, such as seals. Last year, the virus then appeared in dairy cows, and since then in at least 70 humans, most of whom had contact with cows or poultry, showing that the virus is getting better at spilling over into new species. The U.S. is now the global hotspot of known human infections. The threat level has gone up in recent weeks. In January, a Louisiana man was the first person in the U.S. to die after being infected with H5N1. And in February, two more people were hospitalized with bird flu. We've doubled the number of people hospitalized for this virus in the last few weeks, Nuzzo said. Granted, it's from 2 to 4. That's a small numbers jump, but it's still a doubling of the hospitalizations. It's still not clear why hospitalizations are going up, she said. Also in February, there were two new detections of spillovers into dairy cows in Nevada and Arizona, with more mutations discovered and concerns mounting that the virus is now endemic or circulating regularly in cows. Why are experts so worried about flu? Flu is a particularly concerning virus because it is very good at mutating. Different flu variants can also combine with each other in a process called reassortment to make new, potentially more dangerous strains. This ability goes up exponentially if the flu becomes endemic. The virus has tricks up its sleeve to evolve and adapt, said Christopher Haney, an associate professor focused on environmental health, epidemiology, and international health at Johns Hopkins University. It is demonstrating changes, adaptations that are of significant concern for us to be aware of and to be cautious about. Avian influenza, or bird flu, is a disease caused by avian influenza A viruses. H5N1 is a strain within that family. Avian flu A viruses easily infect birds, but tend to be less effective at infecting humans and other species, although it's not impossible. Bird flus are usually sorted into two categories, low and high pathogenicity, referring to how sick a virus makes poultry. H5N1 is a highly pathogenic bird flu. On the rare occasions when highly pathogenic avian influenza does infect people, it can have a high consequence, severe implications for people, Haney said. Can I get bird flu from eating eggs? Bird flu spreads through contact with animals and raw animal products. Most of the known cases in the United States have been in dairy and poultry workers, although in two cases, it's not clear how the patients were infected. There have also been cases of people sickened after contact with backyard flocks, including the Louisiana patient who died. To protect yourself from bird flu, avoid contact with wild animals, especially animals that appear sick or to exhibit odd behaviors, and wash your hands after touching raw food products. Bird flu seems to spread even with fleeting contact, such as a splash of raw milk on a farmer's face, experts say. Other precautions, such as wearing a mask, can also protect you from acquiring influenza viruses, especially if you are cleaning out your chicken coop. Unpasteurized milk can have very high concentration of H5N1, and a study from the U.S. Department of Agriculture also found traces of bird flu in meat that was cooked rare. The virus was inactivated in fully cooked meat. The processes of pasteurization and cooking subject raw ingredients to high enough temperatures to kill many pathogens, including this strain of bird flu, and in general, it's wise to only consume pasteurized milk and fully cooked eggs and meat. Although physical contact with food is a worry, there have not been any known cases of bird flu among people from ingesting tainted food, but officials have warned that it is possible. Meanwhile, mammals such as cats are getting very sick from H5N1 after drinking raw milk and eating raw meat. Can I get tested for or vaccinated against bird flu? If you believe that you may have bird flu, you can ask your doctor to write a referral to a commercial lab that can test for it, such as LabCorp or Quest Diagnostics. You should mention to your doctor why you think you have bird flu, especially if you have been in contact with animals or if you consume raw food products. It's important to note that the people most at risk are frequently not being tested. Farm workers worry about losing their jobs or taking time off from work if they test positive. The U.S. has licensed bird flu vaccines in its national stockpile, but they are not yet being recommended for use in people, nor are they commercially available. Getting a seasonal flu vaccine likely won't help much with H5N1 infection, but it can help reduce the risk of flu reassortment and take some pressure off of health systems. By keeping preventable hospital admissions at bay, institutions are better poised to absorb emergency situations, such as a human infected with H5N1. It also makes it easier for scientists to find rare variants like H5N1 circulating among people when there are fewer positive flu samples to test. There are a lot of reasons to get a seasonal flu shot, particularly this year, one of the worst flu seasons that we've seen in a decade, Nuzzo said. A person who is co-infected with H5N1 and seasonal flu is particularly worrisome because that's probably the most likely scenario to create a pandemic flu virus, Nuzzo said. Worrying about H5N1 20 years ago is why we had a pandemic preparedness plan, why we have things like H5N1 stockpiled vaccines, why we have things like tests and Tamiflu. What roles do factory farms play in the bird flu outbreak? Large industrial farms, known as concentrated animal feeding operations, CAFOs, keep thousands of animals in close quarters, making them a significant breeding ground for viruses and mutations of those viruses. Think about the scale, the numbers of animals within which there are millions to billions of viral copies, which are all reassorting every second, every minute of every day, said Haney. The challenge with the production of so many animal species in confinement conditions is that that represents such a high magnitude reservoir for a virus like this. That's why it's especially important for officials and farm owners to prioritize and protect agricultural workers who frequently come into contact with animals and who may be at risk of getting very sick and passing the virus on to others. Workers live lives. They go to work. They go home. They have families, they live in communities, Haney said. And if we start seeing spread in communities, he asked, would that be too late at that point to stop a pandemic? Does climate change play a role in flu outbreaks? Our changing climate and the ways we reshape land with agriculture and deforestation make new pandemics a greater risk. As humans come into closer contact with more animals, it increases the likelihood of spillover, which happens when a virus moves into a new host, which is what happened when H5N1 moved from birds to cows to people. The conditions that give rise to new viruses that can go on to cause pandemics, those conditions are increasing, Nuzzo said. So the cadence that we saw in previous centuries could very well increase due to changing environmental conditions that make it easier for new viruses to spill over. We have about 3 minutes left, and with that time, I'm going to go ahead and start the third article we'd laid out for today. What's happening at the Bureau of Land Management? A new sagebrush rebellion threatens to transform the agency's mandate from conservation to energy production. This was written by Alexander Nazarin. During his inaugural address at the U.S. Capitol in January, Donald Trump used a slogan made famous by former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, "Drill, baby, drill." It was a blunt promise, one that has long been championed, unsurprisingly, by the oil and gas industry. The Bureau of Land Management during the second Trump administration may play a key role in making that promise a reality, putting protected public lands in the crosshairs. While the public remains fixed on everything from massive federal job cuts to Trump's chaotic tariff policies, the Bureau of Land Management is quietly shifting its mandate from custodianship and conservation to energy production. As a result, public lands could soon play host to a growing number of oil wells and fracking pads. In his first term, Trump appointed Brian Steed, a conservative political figure from Utah, to head the Bureau of Land Management, an arm of the Department of the Interior that manages 256 million acres of land and for the most part across a dozen western states. Steed moved the BLM's headquarters to Colorado. The Biden administration's Interior Secretary, Deborah Haaland, later moved the agency back to Washington. In 2019, Steed was succeeded by William Perry Pendley, a hardline anti-conservation activist who managed to remain on the job well after Biden took office. He was ultimately removed by a judge. Now Trump has nominated Kathleen M. Scamma, a Denver-based energy lobbyist and a contributor to Project 25, which has informed much of the second Trump administration's approach to governance, to helm the BLM. The organizations that have supported Pendley, Scamma, and the like-minded figures have their roots in the Sagebrush Rebellion of the late 20th century, which sought to wrest western lands, from Washington's control. Trump, who has shown little inclination towards spending any time in the outdoors, has fomented a sagebrush rebellion of his own by arguing that the United States is not producing enough energy. As some observers have noted, America is already the world's dominant energy producer. In addition, opening federal lands for drilling would do little to lower gas prices, which are dependent on a complex set of global issues. Demand for oil and gas is likely to decline over time, and most of the major companies understand this, said Mark Squillance, an expert in natural resources law at the University of Colorado Law School. Mark Squillance, that is why there are no enthusiasm for leases in Alaska's Arctic Plain when land there was offered in the waning days of the Biden administration. I'm somewhat optimistic that they're not going to be successful in pushing their oil and gas agenda, Squillis said of the Trump administration. And that concludes the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining me for the March 26th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.